This talk was given at Insight Meditation South Bay. For more information and a schedule of our events, visit the Insight Meditation South Bay website at www.imsb.org. For information about online programs, visit the Bodhi Courses website at www.bodhicourses.org. Bodhi is spelled B-O-D-H-I.
Great Sangha. As long as you mentioned San Luis Obispo, that's where Claudia, my wife, and I live. And we have a great Sangha down there, the Waiheran Sangha. Shaila teaches that for us once in a while. And so if you're ever, you know, passing through that part of the world, check out our website and stop by. We have events 3-4 nights a week at our center. And I think you'd find it very, very much like this group, very compatible. A lot of great people there. So you're always welcome. And thank you so much for inviting me to talk here. Nothing an author likes better than to talk about their book, unless it's talking about themselves, I guess. It's great to be able to do this. You know, it's great that I'm kind of finished with the book and it's out there in the world, although I have to admit, I'm a little sorry it's done. I had such a great time writing it. You know, it was so much fun to just spend my time thinking about the Dharma and everything. It's sort of like a baby, you know, it's an empty nest syndrome, I guess, when your teenagers move out. I don't think I know very many people here, so I thought I'd begin by saying a little about my background, and I got the little, you know, blurb there too. And then I'll do a little reading from the book, and we can maybe talk and answer questions or do whatever else seems to work. So Buddhism, as I mentioned in that bio, has been my anchor and my spiritual path for most of my adult life. And I've been really fortunate. I was a sociologist for a lot of years. I taught down in Cal Poly in San Luis. And sociology is great because you can study anything you want. You just put sociology of in front of it. So sociology of religion. And the more I got into Buddhism, the more I was able to devote my time to that. And that's where that book that she mentioned, it's called the New Buddhism, the Western Transformation of an Ancient Tradition. And that was the first thing I really at length wrote about Buddhism. And boy, it was a great experience. You know, I was able, you know, it's basically about Western Buddhism, like what's happening here, you know. And I was able to go to all these different centers, and I interviewed these really fascinating people. And I was able to do some traveling and explore the transformation of Buddhism. So it was a lot of fun doing that too, but it was a very different kind of book. It was still kind of, I was still the sociologist on the outside looking in, you know, trying to understand Buddhism and how it's changed. And that's a fascinating thing to do. But this is something quite different. This is very much a Buddhist book rather than a book about Buddhism. And to say a little bit about how I came to get involved in this, really the origins were not too far from here, up at across the Golden Gate Bridge, up at the San Francisco Zen Center's Green Gulch Farm. Maybe some of you know about Green Gulch. Another wonderful Dharma jewel you have in the Bay Area, you know, up in Marin, which I think has more Buddhist groups per capita than anywhere on Earth, as far as I know. And those are what inspired me was some talks I heard by Reb Anderson, who was a Roshi there, one of the former abbot. And he gave a series of talks on this wonderful sutra that no one's ever heard of. And a lot of people, including myself for a long time, can't even pronounce it. It's called the Samdhi Nirmochana Sutra. And that sutra is, that title is translated in all kinds of different ways, you know. There's even an article, about 20-page article in this abstract journal, explaining the title. So, and then imagine getting into reading it, actually. But Reb's talks were really amazing. He just really blew me away with how profound his understanding was, but also how profound this wonderful sutra was. And I found it, like I said, profound, fascinating, deep. And I spent years studying it. And I guess, as sort of an academic, I've always been kind of hesitant to really go too much into the philosophy of Buddhism because I thought you kind of get lost in there and you forget about the practice and, you know, and get too involved in you know, the thinking side of it. But this sutra kind of combined the, you know, theoretical and the practical in a really great way that just really kind of opened it up for me, and I thought was really powerful. And I spent years studying it. One of my prized possessions was this text that the Zen Center put together, which has there's three translations into English of the sutra. And they have them side by side in columns, so you can just jump from one to the other, because a lot of times when you try to read it, you'd get the stuff that didn't make any sense. So you could just switch over to somebody else's translation, and eventually it sort of slowly kind of opened it up. The sutra is over 100 pages, so in the translation, so it says a lot of stuff. But among other things, and the thing that really kind of inspired me to do this much simpler kind of thing, is that it sort of organized and systematically put all the different Buddhist teachings together in a way that kind of made sense. In that sutra, it's called the Three Turnings of the Wheel. And maybe you had the experience of hearing different Buddhist teachings from different teachers that seemed to be contradicting each other, or you know, somehow didn't make sense. And this sutra helps kind of organize it. And this idea of the three turnings of the wheel has widely spread now from the sutra. A lot of teachers use this idea. But what really amazed me, that I thought the sutra was so great, but no one's ever heard of it. Even Buddhist teachers I talked to say, no, I don't know about that one, you know. And so I thought, well, you know, this should really get some more attention. People ought to pay attention to this wonderful sutra. And so I went to Reb and asked him if I could maybe take his talks and turn them into a book. Maybe naively I said that. It was a lot bigger job than I thought, but Reb graciously said yes and got some help and had a lot of his talks transcribed. But I remember at one point being pretty overwhelmed by that undertaking. I remember sitting there looking at my desk, and there's a stack of about 1,000 pages of all these transcripts of all these talks he'd given over the last, you know, I don't know, 5 or 6 years, and a lot of them on the same subjects and different takes. And I just thought, oh man, I can't know if I can do this. But ultimately, you know, it comes into place, and that happened. And that book came out in 2011. It was called The Third Turning of the Wheel, The Wisdom of the Samdhi-Nirmocana Sutra. And I'm probably biased, but I think it's a wonderful book. You ought to all check it out. But it's pretty difficult. It's fairly high level. I mean, this is, you know, some difficult stuff in there. And probably a little higher level than most people would delve into. And of course, it didn't cover the full range of Buddhist teachings, just the so-called third turning. Didn't talk about the first or second. So it occurred to me that you don't really have to be a scholar or a yogi or a, you know, academic or anything like that to get tremendous benefits from studying the sutras and learning from the sutras. And by the way, I'm using the word sutra. You may hear it as sutta, and maybe that's more familiar to you. It's the same thing. Sutra is Sanskrit, and sutta is Pali. So you could substitute sutta. I'm using the word sutra because that applies to all of them, where usually the second and third turnings just use the Sanskrit name because they're not in Pali. In fact, this sutra, the Samdhi-Nirmocana Sutra, is not even in Sanskrit anymore. That has been lost, but it was translated into Tibetan and Chinese and then from there into English. Yeah, I should have said that right off the bat because you probably use the word sutta more, right? So excuse me for that. But basically, you know, Buddhist text. So anyway, it occurred to me that anybody could reap profound benefits from reading these. And I imagine you mentioned the class on the Satipatthana Sutta, which is, you know, one of the key suttas in the first turning. And wonderful work. You could spend your whole life studying that. And you don't have to go any farther than that. But there's all these other wonderful sutras out there too. So I'm sure that class is amazing because you get to really... And that sutta, if I recall correctly, is, I don't know, what is it, 5 or 6 pages? Not very long. So it's not like this massive undertaking or anything. But I think anyone can get tremendous benefits from this kind of study, but I think, in a way, our educational system gets in the way. Because in our educational system, it's kind of almost a star system where you have the A student and then everybody else kind of feels like, don't quite cut it, you know. And so, you know, some people will try reading one of these and get to a part they don't understand and then feel inadequate or frustrated or like, I'll never get it type of thing. And so the key is, I think, just setting aside your doubts and realizing that these things are sometimes hard to understand, and that's good. In fact, if you read something in some of these sutras and you get it right away, you think you get it right away, that's really an obstacle, you know, because these things are way deeper than you can imagine, some of the things in there. And so being a little, you know, overconfident about your understanding is a barrier. Not getting in going, what is this talking about? That can be exactly the right place to be with some of these things. But you got to be just kind of comfortable with that, you know. But I think you do need some help when you read these things. For one thing, they're very repetitious. As you may know, these things were memorized for hundreds of years, many of these, before they were written down. So passed on from generation to generation of monks. And of course, when you do that, you need these kind of repetitive passages that makes it easier. So a lot of them repeat themselves a lot. And then there's the unfamiliar terms and you know, alien cultural assumptions and things. So my goal in writing this was to provide that kind of assistance, to make it these things open up, hopefully just to anybody who didn't even have any Buddhist experience. So my goal then in doing that was, I tried to figure out, well, how do you do that? How do you make it readable and, you know, understandable, but still keep people in touch with these original kind of classic teachings? And so my idea was to take little passages out of various sutras, or suttas, if you will, and just a few sentences, and then, you know, explain them in plain English that anybody can understand. So part of my fun in doing this was trying to kind of mine for nuggets, you know, these little short passages taken out of all these classic texts. And fortunately, there's kind of consensus among Buddhist folks about which are the really, you know, important sutras and the ones that everybody, like the Satipatthana Sutta is one example like that. But I didn't want the book just to be about theory, so I asked two people I would consider great meditation teachers to contribute a chapter, and both of these chapters are ones that I put together from the lectures that these two teachers gave, but, you know, they're really the authors. One from Reb Anderson, the Roshi that I mentioned, and another from another of my teachers, Lama Paulden Drolma. And of course, Reb is in the Zen tradition. Lama Paulden is in the Vajrayana, or the Tibetan tradition. And so the idea was that they would talk about how to really, you know, put these teachings to work. Because there's no point, Buddhism is not about learning stuff or getting some knowledge. It's about liberation. So Reb's chapter, I think, is a really great way to show you how to work with these teachings in your practice and how to alternate between concentration and what's called shamatha and vipassana or insight and work back and forth with these great teachings. Lama Paulden's perspective, from a Tibetan perspective, shows that the teaching, you know, the foundations are the same in all the traditions. It's all basically the same. But she goes into a uniquely Tibetan kind of practice, and that's Tara practice, the visualization of this great female enlightened being. Very interesting practice. So if you get a chance to read that chapter sometime, I think you'll find it really, really interesting. It's a practice I've done a lot and really got huge amounts from. So hopefully this is something that, this book is something people could just pick up without any Buddhist experience, or if you excuse me, have a lot of experience, something that may help you get back in touch with the classic foundations of the tradition. So I've been talking for a while. I want to read a little bit from the book. But before I do, any questions or anything you want to bring up first? Okay. So I gave a talk up at a bookstore in Seattle a few months ago, and they were very organized. They had this very long list of things you should do and shouldn't do. And one of the things that do not do is do not read from your book for more than 6 to 8 minutes or everyone will go to sleep. Now, as a professor, I couldn't possibly limit my former professor and myself that short, but if you want to doze off, that's okay, you know, no problems. So I'm going to read something from the very first chapter, and it's a section called Turning the Wheel of Dharma. And the reason I picked that is it gives you a really good idea, I hope, of what the book's about and kind of this idea of what the three turnings of the wheel are all about. So let me go in and we'll see how we get. And if any time, you know, you have a question or anything, feel free to, you know, let me know. So the great wheel of Buddhist teachings has been spinning for more than 2,000 years and has left a vast ocean of Dharma. 100 generations of continuous practice, teaching, and reflection have left us with more treasures of wisdom than anyone can count, let alone read and assimilate. And so this metaphor of the wheel of Dharma is really a great one. The turning of the wheel is like, the teachings of the Buddha, and the teachings of the successors, the Buddhist teachings. So anyone, more than anyone can read or assimilate. Fortunately, there's no reason we have to. In a very real sense, the teachings simply say the same thing over and over again in endless new languages to an ever-changing audience. At the heart of all true Dharma, there is a timeless wisdom beyond language or conception, and the wheel of teachings spins round and round it, pointing the way back to its source. So the metaphor is really a great one, I think, of this wheel, because at the center, at the hub, there are these teachings that are really nothing you can really verbalize. They're really beyond that. And all these teachings are different languages and different traditions pointing at this real experience of awakening, you know. And so they're all, in a sense, kind of spinning around, you know, saying the same thing for the same reason, to help bring us to liberation. Despite its jaw-breaking name, the great Samdhi Nirmochana Sutra, or the Sutra of the explanation of the profound secrets, can do a lot to help us make sense of these teachings and see how they fit together. It tells us of the three turnings of the wheel of Dharma, each with its own distinct teachings, building upon but not replacing its predecessors. So again, the idea is that the three turnings are three kind of cycles of teaching. And it's not like the later teachings, you know, replace the earlier ones. In fact, in the earlier ones, the Pali Canon, you know, for example, those are complete teachings in and of themselves. But then on top of those, these other layers are added, which can add more understanding and more flexibility and more depth if, you're inclined to go in that direction. So in the first turning of the wheel, the Buddha, like a doctor diagnosing a disease, spelled out the cause of suffering and what to do about it in clear, unambiguous terms. These are called the Four Noble Truths, and I imagine most of you have heard of the Four Noble Truths, right? But despite that fact, I'm going to tell you, keep reading and tell you what the Four Noble Truths are in words of two sentences, which isn't bad. And the first of the Noble Truths, he taught that the unenlightened life is full of suffering, or, you know, the word is dukkha in Pali. And it's sometimes translated also as unsatisfactory, lots of different ways to look at that. Second, he identified the cause of suffering, and of course that's craving and attachment. And third, he made it clear that craving and attachment can be ended. And in the fourth Noble Truth, he laid out his treatment program, the Eightfold Noble Path. One thing I want to say about the second Noble Truth is that a lot of people think of Buddhism as kind of depressing, it's all about suffering and stuff like that, but they're ignoring the third Noble Truth, which is there is an end to suffering. It does not say that life is only suffering. It says, in fact, that you can end suffering. That is what, if you follow the path and follow the Eightfold Noble Path, you can end your suffering. So actually, it's a really optimistic philosophy. You know, it's not at all depressing. It's just that, some people are kind of, especially Westerners, I think, have misinterpreted that. So anyway, he told his followers, and this is the Eightfold Noble Path, that if they behave with ethics and compassion, meditated diligently, and cultivated wisdom based on his teachings, they could end their suffering and achieve the ultimate release of Nibbana or Nirvana, Sanskrit Nirvana, Pali Nibbana. And the reason I just list three of those is usually you take the Eightfold Noble Path, you can break it down into these three, you know, three components: wisdom, meditation, and compassionate, loving behavior, you know. And so the idea is if you treat people with kindness and love and you act ethically, and that's the foundation for everything else, and then you meditate and then you develop wisdom and understanding, you can liberate yourself from suffering. Okay. In these teachings, suffering is the disease, or like the disease anyway. Craving is the cause. The Eightfold Noble Path of wisdom, ethical conduct, and meditation is the cure, and freedom is the result. So this is the metaphor of the doctor. That, you know, you've got this disease, which is suffering. The Buddha is the doctor. He gives you the instructions of how to end the suffering. Here's what you do. Very logical, very systematic, and of course, very, very powerful. So what do we need to go beyond the first turnings for? Well, that's a good question. And I think the answer is that some people got attached to those teachings. So let me read this. It says, even though the Buddha often warned his followers not to make his teachings into just something else to cling to, and he said in many places in the Pali Canon, for example, that, you know, the teachings are just a help, you know, like a raft to get you across the river. You don't have to keep carrying the teachings. But many people did. Many people found them so profound and helpful, they did exactly that. That is, they clung to them. So in the second turning, the Buddha did something unprecedented in the history of world religion. He dropped a bombshell that blew apart that clinging, and along with it everything else many of the followers of his earliest teachings believed. In the Diamond Sutra, the Buddha tells us that he really has nothing at all to teach, and anyone who says he does slanders him. In the Diamond Sutra, it says, the Buddha says, is quoted as saying, I have nothing to teach, and if you say I teach anything, you're slandering me. Whoa, the great teacher is not a teacher? And you're insulting him by saying he's a teacher? What does that mean? And that's no easy answer to that, by the way. Just kind of sit with that. In the Heart Sutra, we are told that everything, absolutely everything, is empty. And in that emptiness, there is no suffering, no cause of suffering, no end of suffering, and no noble path to lead to suffering. In case you didn't notice, that's the Four Noble Truths. And the Heart Sutra explicitly denies each one of those. There's no path, no suffering, no end of suffering, and so on. The Buddha seemed to be denying all his own teachings. And when I say this is unprecedented in the history of world religion, I think it is. It would be like Jesus would say, well, I was just kidding, you know, there really isn't any God, you know. Or Muhammad would say the Quran really isn't a holy book. It's kind of inconceivable in those traditions, and yet here it is in the Buddhist tradition. So I think it's really powerful. And it's not really denying this. It's not saying these are not valuable. But it's just saying, you know, at some point, these are just words. And liberation isn't any group of words, nor how profound they are. Obviously, the radical wisdom of the second turning is, as the sutras often say, difficult, extremely difficult to understand. And it left a lot of people amazed and confused. And this is one of the explanations why these two teachings weren't taught very widely for like 500 years after the original teachings. The sutras even tell us that when some of the Buddha's followers first heard those teachings, they fell down, vomited blood, and died. Now, I'm taking that to be a metaphor. I don't think too many people probably died from hearing these teachings, but they were pretty radical. Imagine you were a monk devoting your life to following this path, and you heard these teachings that, well, there is no path. But I want to get enlightened. Oh, there is no attainment. There is no enlightenment. You know, what? You know, that's radical stuff. Okay. So some mistook the new teachings for some kind of shocking rejection of the older ones, which they weren't at all. While others fell victim to a kind of nihilism, reasoning that if everything is empty, then nothing really matters, and they are free to do whatever they please, regardless of the consequences to others. And that's the biggest perversion you can find of the Buddha's real teachings, of course. But, you know, some people got confused. So now we have a third turning coming along, which the third turning of the wheel sought to rectify such mistaken beliefs and provide more guidance to those who seem to have had their feet cut out from under them. The first step was to explain the apparent contradictions between the first turning of the wheel and the second. Again, apparent contradictions. In the Sutra of the Explanation of the Profound Secrets, that's the Sandhimir Mochana Sutra I talked about, the Buddha tells us that words are just conventional designations. That's the translation. That he uses to help free us from suffering, and that no matter how different they seem, all the teachings are of one taste. Okay? So it says very explicitly, words are just... At one point, there's a questioner who asks the Buddha a difficult contradiction, asking to explain. And he says, well, these are just words. I just make them up, and I just use them to help people with. And, you know, it doesn't matter which words I use. Like a good doctor, the Buddha gave different medicines to different patients depending on their individual needs. He might tell one person about the Four Noble Truths, and in the next breath, someone else that those truths were completely empty. But the goal was always the same, to free them from their suffering. So, again, the teachings are not designed to be a philosophy. They're designed to help liberate people, free people from their suffering. And so, if you need to hear the Four Noble Truths, then those teachings are there. If you need to hear the Four Noble Truths are empty, maybe, you know, later on in your practice, then those teachings are there. The teachings of the third turning go on to give monks, give more explicit guidance to practitioners by painting a profound picture of the way the conscious and subconscious minds operate. And I'm not going to get into that tonight, but there's something called the Alaya Vijnana, which is introduced by the Sandhimir Mochana Sutra. It means the subconscious mind. Kind of like what Freud discovered, except 1,500 years earlier, maybe the third century of the Common Era. And it really helps understand, it's not just theory, it really helps us understand our practice and the obstacles that we run into. But again, I don't have time to really get into that, unless you wanted to bring it up in the question period. So, it helps explain the conscious and unconscious mind and the inconceivable ultimate, the awakened Buddha nature from which they all arise. And these teachings on the ultimate, the Buddha nature or the Dharmakaya or the Absolute, lots of names, they're tricky. And in the early teachings, they didn't use those terms too much, although in the suttas they talk about the deathless and, you know, some things that are pretty similar. But there's a danger that you're going to grasp onto these and think they're some kind of self. So it took, you know, 400 or 500 years of teaching before these teachings really were safe to spread, or at least that's the way Reb Anderson looked at it. And just one more paragraph, and then you can, I'll wake you from your slumbers here. Some people take these teachings as nothing more than abstract philosophy that doesn't make much difference in the real world. But the Buddha never really cared much about philosophy. He cared about freeing people from their suffering, and these teachings can do exactly that. And that's the point. You know, this is very different than, say, Western psychology or Western philosophy. The goal was not to have an understanding of the world. The goal was to free people from suffering. And the wisdom of these teachings not only provides a key to free us from our endless chains of deluded thought, but also serves as a practical guide to lead practitioners to progressively deeper stages of meditation. Following these teachings of the first turning, we learn to purify and refine our behavior, release our cravings, and ultimately see the emptiness of self. In the second turning, we go even deeper to realize not just the emptiness of self, but the emptiness of absolutely everything else as well. And finally, the teaching of the third turning points directly to the ultimate, at the source of all appearance and emptiness, to our awakened Buddha nature, beyond all description or understanding. So that's the reading I wanted to do. I'll throw it over for some questions now, I guess. And I've been told to repeat the questions back, because otherwise they won't be on the recording. So... anybody want to dive in? Or we can sit and meditate for a while. Boy, you guys are really wise. Oh, there we go. Three hands show up. How about in the back there? Yeah, how about you? Then you, yeah. What's your name?
Daphne.
Daphne. Okay, thanks.
I was interested in what you were saying about kind of words.
Yes.
It is. Like it's,
the word is kind of sacred, yeah.
Yeah. And here it seems
Okay. Different.
Yes.
Yeah, so the question is, well, in the Western tradition, words are really important. In fact, they're kind of sacred and special. And so what's this idea that words aren't that important? That's a really interesting question. And I think in the Jewish tradition, you know, the mystical tradition, the words have a sacred, I think the words actually create the universe, don't they? I'm not too familiar with that. But. Well, I guess there's a lot of answers to that. There's a psychological answer, which is, what do we do all day long, you know, day in and day out, is we talk to ourselves in our words, and we weave this. This is where the metaphor of the dream that comes from the title, you know, the Buddha's dream. Because any words are kind of dreams, but the Buddha's dreams and words are really valuable, help liberate us. Our dreams and words are kind of trap us, you know, that we're always thinking, and we're separating ourselves off from our experience, from other people, from our lives with all these words, you know. This is me, that's you, you know, this and that, you know, and we're trapped in these words. So I think the psychological answer to that is that the words, as useful as they are, can also be our trap. As these, you know, mammals with these super overgrown brains, we get lost up there. So that's one way to look at it. But you could do it a lot of other ways too. I guess another way would be to say that the heart of Buddhism is the experience of liberation. And so that's not the same as the words. The words, there's a famous metaphor in the Lankavatara Sutra about the words, the teachings being like a finger pointing at the moon. A lot of you probably heard that. It's fairly popular in Zen. You know, the teachings point you at the state of liberation, but the words are just words. The state of liberation is beyond words. In fact, it's beyond subject and object, dualism, which are kind of what our language is based on. So the awakened state isn't language and isn't words. So that's some way to play with it anyway. It's a great topic. And what I love about this Sanjay-Nirmocana Sutra is very explicit about talking about how there's one line is something like the realization of the saints, they translate it as, or the yogis, is beyond words, beyond understanding, unlike common people who, you know, deal with that. Anything else on that one? Yeah. Right.
Is that something that you see as being pointed out or dealt with more with the third turning versus the second? Because it doesn't seem to be covered in the first turning much at all.
Okay, let me kind of paraphrase that. So do I see that this idea of going beyond dualism is more developed, let's say, or more prominent in the second and third turnings than in the first turning? Okay. It's more explicit, I think, you know, that in the Sanjay-Nirmocana Sutra than other sutras like Third Turning. They very explicitly say that, you know, about some. But I think, you know, in the First Turning, it's the same thing. It's just maybe expressed in different terms, I think, you know. And you can find stuff in the Pali Canon, like there's one sutta, I forget the name, where the Buddha says there are two extremes. One's extreme is believing that things exist, and another extreme is believing they don't exist. So they're very much, you know, these same teachings. They just weren't emphasized as much, you know. So, I think all the teachings, I mean, you know, the idea of nirvana in the first turning is a state beyond dualism, you know, although in the first turning teachings, they don't really tell you much what nirvana is like because, again, you get trapped in the words and stuff. Yeah, it's a really good question, though. So I tend to see that the core is the same on all the three turnings, although you will get people who say, well, this, you know, it's really the first turning is what the Buddha really said, and then nothing else counts. Or some people say, well, these later sutras are more sophisticated and they're better, you know. But I think the point is that they're all pointing at liberation. It's just a matter of what do you connect with? What is what you need at this time, you know? What's going to help you deal with your suffering? Yeah.
Just a follow-up question.
Sure. What do I see as the relationship between awakening and non-dualism? That's a good question. I'm not exactly sure what, you know, the meaning of non-dualism is, but if it's the idea of going beyond, you know, subject and object and, you know, seeing the, you know, beyond our conceptual categories, I think it is awakening, absolutely. And I know there's a whole kind of non-dual community that, you know, which I'm not a part of so much, but I think that would be their understanding, and I think it's very much the same. Yeah. That's one of the things that's sort of interesting about these third turning teachings is they're so explicit about language and, you know, words, and so sophisticated for the third century. And the way they discovered the subconscious mind, you know, 15 centuries ago. In the West, we thought we were so smart to find out about it in the 19th century, you know. And in many ways, I think actually the Buddhist understanding of the subconscious is more sophisticated than the Freudian understanding, but that's a whole other topic we probably don't want to delve into tonight. Did I see another question? Didn't somebody else have a hand up here? Yeah, huh? Yeah, are nirvana and liberation the same? Yeah, I would think so. You know, they say awakening, nirvana, liberation. There's lots of different words. Realization is another one people use. And again, you know, they're just words. They don't really reach to, but I'd say essentially the same. The problem is that a word like nirvana can get so lofty. You know, it sounds like, oh, you know, nirvana. And then you start grasping onto it. So then sometimes they'll change the word and say, well, awakening. And to me, that sounds a little, you know, more, I don't know, down to earth, I guess. But what do you think? I mean, does that sound that way to you? Yeah.
Liberation means liberation from what aspect?
Liberation from suffering. Yeah, liberation from suffering. That's the core of the Buddha's teachings is, you know, we have this suffering, we have these difficulties, we have this, you know, look around the world, right? It's not hard to see the suffering. And he's saying this optimistic message that you can be liberated from suffering. And that state you could call nirvana or nibbana in Pali. And but again, you don't have to apply a fancy name like that. Just say freedom, openness, you know, whatever. Somebody else? Yeah.
I'm curious about your practice with Tara vision.
Okay. Yeah, I love Tara practice. So, in fact, I have a pendant here. This is a Tibetan letter Tom, which is her seed syllable. And so I really love Tara practice. I actually got into it. I had a bunch of problems with my eye and had a lot of trouble. You know, maybe some of you had that where I had to, like, keep my head down 24 hours a day with a bubble in there. And so I decided I'm just going to practice all the time. And because what else could you do, you know? And I got into Tara practice in a really deep way. So if you're not familiar, how many know what a Tara practice or visualization practice? Anybody done that? Well, not many. Okay, well, that's something interesting that some of you might want to, you know, look at sometime. The idea is that in the Tibetan tradition, let me put this. They will, as you may know, when they meditate, you might meditate on Tara. So you would visualize her presence and try to feel her in front of you. And you would recite a mantra that would kind of help evoke that feeling. You would do a visualization. And you would feel her blessings and her love coming to you. And then ultimately, you would imagine that you were Tara. Okay, and that may sound really strange. You've never done this. But the idea is, in a way, from a psychological standpoint, by visualizing yourself as a, what they call yidam, an enlightened being, in this case, this great female Buddha, that helps, you know, kind of imagining yourself that way helps you get there. And it helps speak to layers of your subconscious, and remember, the subconscious is very important in Buddhism, kind of end round around your logical mind that's saying, you can't ever get enlightened, you have all these failings, and you have these problems, and, you know, that can be a real obstacle. You do these visualizations of yourself as this enlightened, you know, divine being, and you can get the feeling that that kind of goes around your rational mind, reaches down to these really deep levels. So it's a great practice. Actually, Lama Paldin, whose name Her Buddhist name is Palindroma, which means glorious Tara. Her chapter talks about that, and so there's actually a really simple meditation you could try if you want to try that sometime. And it's a great practice. Of course, in the Tibetan tradition, there's so many different practices. Like, have like just unbelievable number. Nobody could even, you know them all, much less do them all. So it's a matter of connecting up with, you know, what you want to do. So it really helps to work with a good lama who knows kind of you and can figure out, you know, what's the right thing for you as an individual. But it's a great practice. And I think maybe it's particularly useful in this day and age where it seems like there's so much kind of this negative masculine energy around. We hear about it all the time, to help kind of rebalance some of that energy in our culture. You know, and I think it's a practice that would be, is very helpful for that kind of thing. Yeah. Yeah. Hmm?
You mentioned alternating between concentration practices and then insight.
That's yes.
Could you just speak a little bit about, you know,
sure.
Yeah,
absolutely. And again, it's the chapter from Reb Anderson, he goes into detail about this. He's really a great meditation teacher. But just briefly, do you all know those two differences in Sanskrit, or it's called in Pali too, I think, shamatha and vipassana, or concentration and insight. Okay. So concentration is like when you follow your breath, that's concentrating. Insight is when you use that concentrated mind and you use it to gain wisdom. In the first turning teachings, they usually emphasize looking at things like impermanence or suffering or something like that, using your concentrated attention to see the impermanence of things. Or in the second and third turning, you might use that attention to see the emptiness of things. And so as Reb teaches it, you get really concentrated. You have to be concentrated and calm and pliant first. Otherwise, you can't do Vipassana very well. And then once you're calm, you've got that, and this may take years to really develop that power, then you switch over to Vipassana, and perhaps you look at impermanence, and you watch the arising and passing away of each moment. And then, and this is something that I think Reb is really skillful with, that can be kind of agitating, because when you watch stuff, the impermanence of things, pretty soon, what are you going to see as impermanent? Me. Yeah, I'm not going to be here. That can get you very agitated. So if that happens, then you go back to your shamatha and get calm again. And then once you're calm, you can go back to your vipassana. And of course, it doesn't have to be impermanence, but that's one of the central things. I'm just using that as an example. And so by working back and forth between those two, you can deepen your understanding. And then if you really get it at a deep subconscious level, and again, I like to emphasize that at subconscious level, that impermanence, that yes, everything is impermanent, including me, that kind of changes you. You know, and then there are other meditations you could go on to, you know, if you wanted. But that's the idea. That's a really good question. But again, if you're interested, take a look at that chapter that Reb has in there. He goes into that, and he's a really great teacher of that approach. Okay, anybody else? Are we getting, yeah, one more? Yes.
Vipassana is kind of analyzing the moving things, like impermanent things. So one is stable, one is moving. How it can operate together?
Yeah, one is, he's saying that shamatha is stable and vipassana is more moving. Well, that's a really good question. The idea is you have to, if you're going to do the investigation, the inquiry of vipassana, you have to have a stable, calm mind. But you can have a stable, calm mind and still have thoughts going on. It's not like you have to be blank. And the thoughts are actually your guide in Vipassana at the beginning. The thoughts guide you to look at impermanence and guide you in other ways. But the goal is not, you know, thoughts, but the thoughts can point you in that direction. And then if you have that stability from your shamatha combined with the insight of the Vipassana, you know, the penetrating insight, that's a really deep kind of state, and that's the kind of thing the Buddha worked with. And by the way, you know, historically it said that there were a lot of shamatha, you know, concentration teachings at the time of the Buddha, but it was Buddha's unique contribution to bring in the vipassana, the insight work, and combine that. But I think everyone that I know says that the foundation is the concentration, the calm, tranquil, pliant mind. You know, if you don't have that, then you're not going to get as far with your vipassana. Okay, well, I guess we're just about out of time. One more question or not? Yeah. Yeah, that's a big question. Just to really briefly, it's said that in, you know, if you read the suttas in the first turning, often there's a sense of getting rid of afflictive emotions, you know. And then it's said in the Zen teachings, as you may hear, it's more sort of just accepting them. And I think there's some of that in the first turning. And then in the third turning and in the Vajrayana, especially the Tibetan approach, the idea is you transform the emotions. You would take the fear or the anger and actually transform that. There's a wisdom in the anger, like the wisdom of anger is what they call the mirror-like wisdom. You know, so you'd actually transform that energy, not get rid of it or just accept it, but actually use that to drive your practice. But that's a really short answer to a really big question. I think I'm going to probably have to cut it off at that point, though. So thank you so much for coming tonight. It's been great having you here. I think it's about that magic hour. It is. So thank you so much. That was great.